Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get started. This is Sonic Home Companion, and you've discovered us again. Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to have the audience reaching us early in the morning. I'd like to thank all of you for great support. I wish you, is it time? Wish you all a very Merry Christmas. Get in the spirit, I think, and I hope. It's an exciting time of year, too. Boy, I can tell from all of the weird things going on around your properties that you're out there secretly looking up at the sky, getting ready for a winter solstice. It's all you devil-worshipping sons of guns. that'll come back to bite me, you know that. Thanks, Louie. we're just a week away from the solstice. You know, it's a lot of tradition. That's something that just has followed mankind. And are we so clever at the age of reason to do away with that? Well, today I'm going to try and convince you all that there's a reason to pay attention to these types of events and bring them forward in our minds and in our souls. Okay? This is... you all know, of course, you're all experts. I'm trying to find a commercial here that's on the internet, and this just will make you feel so good. It's about Maple Leaf House in London. Two pilots, you might have already seen it, two pilots from Air Canada walk in. The place is packed with Canadians, and it's an evening, and everybody's having a good time, and, you know, a bit of nostalgia. It's before the holidays, and these guys do something so wonderful for the people in the room. I'm not going to tell you what it is, and no on a spoiler alert, but if you can get a chance to check it out, by all means. Here's a little bit of background music. Here's a little bit of background before we get started. Just want to set the mood. I'm getting ready to change the opening music after all these years. I want something that's, you know, stays a little more contemporary. As contemporary as you can be with a bunch of ancients, eh? This is the sounds of a medieval tavern. And I think it's sort of... if we're hunkered down, it's like the attitude I'd like you to have in mind. If I can, you know, if we can bring that all together, here we are sitting together. You hear the music and the people talking. Just the ambience, isn't it? There you are. You're sitting at the cross from the trestle table. Yep. What if we got a bird on the table in front of us that we've bought to split amongst us, and a pint of ale? Yep. It's a way to do this work, I think, eh? We're going to talk about a little bit about masonry, but a whole lot about how it affects us and what it means to us. Yeah, and I think that's a kind of important. I think I've been thinking that I've been taking the old horse out and trying to get it to do things that perhaps it was just a little bit beyond its capability. A little bit about the mindset for today's show, okay? Then I titled this "Once We Were Young," and that can you can apply that to yourself or to Masonry in general. A Masonic lodge is an exchange, I suggest. It's where wealth becomes philanthropy. It's where the intelligence of a young man, a merchant, the farmer, or a tradesman becomes honed. It's where commitment is made to the power of the mind. Think about it. Ambition and ego are put into harness. It is where a simple fool rubs shoulders with giants and genius. I'll be the simple fool. A man who can open his mind to new ideas finds confidence being in a constant state of apprenticeship. It is in this alchemist's laboratory where time is compressed. The greatest leaders of history teach him that leadership is a service. His own humility quietly mocks conspicuous displays of wealth. He peels away the hallmark of nouveau riche. He becomes part of a history bigger than himself, yet not worth mentioning. That's Freemasonry, where we can, I think, admit that at initiation, you were a bit intoxicated, emotionally overwhelmed, emotionally intoxicated. And I'm here to reveal yet another secret about Masonry. Yes. They've got the Morgan rowboat ready for me in upstate New York. You know, here I go. I'm not going to publish it, but here it goes. Here. You've been brought in to the, have you noticed, boys, as alert and sharp as you ever were, age has had no bearing on your abilities. You're the phenomena. Have you noticed that you're part of the Pythagorean college? Have you noticed that? You think about it. You don't study it, do you? Shame on us. We don't talk about it in lodge. Get with the program, boys. Take a look. Take a look around. What was Pythagoras? What was the college about with Pythagoras? It was a bit of a... It was hard. It was hard. Not everybody got in. Well, that's because they didn't have enough benches to fill in, 100,000 fellows with... half of them sitting there, droopy-eyed, dressed up because that's all they wanted to do, and liking the architecture because it was important just to get in, but really having no interest in what was going on. This has been happening in Masonry for so long. We actually see these arcs. I'm going to talk to you about the arcs of ARK, A-R-K, of Grand Lodges. Now think about this. Just a way of thinking about it. Don't get all literal on me. I'll just get disappointed in us all again. This is all allegory. The idea is that we have entered, we have the opportunity to study lessons. Now we know that not a lot is known about Pythagoras, because after his death, there was a purge. All of his colleges were destroyed. We're not quite sure, but we can tell it had something to do with the politics of the day. And yet his work prevails. We don't study it for odd reasons. Again, the old ancients among us dust ourselves off, look around the room and say, oh my goodness, we're not at all surprised. Not at all surprised that we don't study this. Of course not. We paste this in front of ourselves. We dangle these little baubles and trinkets and adornments and decorations that are symbols of Pythagoras. And yet, who takes a look at it? Who asks, why is that hanging in front of me? why do I wear this? And why is he wearing that? Nobody. What do you? Oh, jeez. It's because, you know, you have to fight your way through, just like you're in Athens. There your rear end sitting in Athens, and you're sitting down at the city center, okay? What's it called? The Agora. And there you are with, you're trying to find your own kind. We haven't advanced to the 18th century yet where we can head off to the penny universities and sit down with each other and have a cup of coffee and talk amongst the writers and the poets and the scientists and the tradesmen. We're not divided up like that. We're back in the day where there's just this great honking mass. Well, how are we going to know that there's a half a dozen other like-minded people in the room? Masonry hasn't failed. My gosh, I keep hearing this. Masonry's got to do more. Keep chasing your tails. Us. Keep chasing the tail of the dog. We cannot recruit like this. But keep doing it. You know, there's nothing wrong with a banquet room that's full compared to one where there's that awkward, self-conscious silence. We've been to that. A few of us have organized events that had a lot of the details and courtesies built into it. And we look around and the room is empty, relatively empty. The disappointment isn't so much that we've done something wrong. The disappointment is the reality of the fact that there's very few people that get it. Very few people that get it. And that's the way it's always been. We're a little more generous in our hearts than Pythagoras was. You had to earn it in his day. And if you didn't earn it, he really didn't care. The first thing he would say to you is when you came through the door, shut up. You have nothing to say. You have everything to learn. Your first year or two, was it 2 years, was in silence. Oh my goodness. Nobody told us. To hell they didn't. Look at the motto of the Grand Lodge of Canada and the province of Ontario. Aude vide tace. Listen. What's the first one? Aude. Listen. What's the only way you can listen? You shut up. You stop listening. You stop being addicted to the sound of your own voice. You get control over your emotions. Sitting in a room quietly is not a bad thing. Oh, my goodness, how many times do you listen to that idle chatter? People that often have something to say very little. It's these chatterboxes, these popinjays that just carry on. It's not new, and no, it's not about that person. It's a phenomena of our culture of being around other human beings. It's neither good nor bad. It is what it is, but it reveals a great deal about masonry. We're to listen. That's abundantly clear. We don't know anything. My goodness, now look at what we've done. You want to see how brilliant we are. All of these very excellent pieces of work are coming out, opinions and reactions. And I'd ask any one of the listeners out there, tell me about the essential points of masonry as you see it. And it's valid. But all of these opinions are thrown into this great ocean. We can't find them. If we want to, we can't find them. They just float around us, like those 3 trillion bits of plastic that we've dumped into the ocean as we've tried to make it into a sewer. It's out there, but there may be an important, brilliant paragraph of information that was written by your member of your lodge or you floating by me, and how in the world would I know? Well, we wouldn't have a clue. And we're contributing to that mess more every single day. More, we're printing more, we're delivering, we're communicating more and more and more, but we are terrible librarians. We're a disgrace. I don't mean disgrace like we should be ashamed of ourselves. I mean disgrace like, what the hell? We're brighter than this. Look around, boys. The library is closed and all this stuff has just been thrown into a sinkhole, this ocean of information. This is where I think the idea of Grand Lodges as arcs. Freemasonry is the thinking, the philosophy on which the Grand Lodges float. It's not the other way around. I challenge anyone to say that. People who are, those arcs float in different places of the world to keep things organized, right? That's a good thing. That is a good thing. It makes things organized. That's what I'm saying about our work and stewardship as librarians. We organize as a grand lodge for the sake of offering some leadership and control to keep records. When it comes to that ocean of information on which grand lodges float, all the puffery and circumstance aside, these men that are elected as our representatives in Grand Lodge everywhere, not just in one jurisdiction, everywhere, are allegorical leaders, symbols of something else, a time gone past, of information, of philosophy. One would expect, and I think should expect, scholarship. You see why the program exists? Because this kind of a topic would be, my goodness, what? Inflammatory? Get me hung? Probably. But I also think it's the gentlest way that we can move into the future. Get down off the ramparts and put your clubs and swords away. This isn't a battle. The Grand Lodges have floated and kept things organized and got us to this point in history. And we can do nothing else in our meager little lives but show gratitude for every bit of that work. Now, the 21st century, we can look around at the opportunities on and over the edge of the horizon, just as our brethren have always done. Not this arrogance about the 21st century being primary and all the rest not mattering or being wrong. My goodness, what have we come to? If that's the only way we can approach this, what have we come to? We're losing the point. Think of these arcs. Then they're full. Two of every kind of mindset. And they're all in them. Everything has been included in these arcs. And they float on this huge ocean of knowledge. And yeah, it includes alchemy. It includes the sciences and the arts. Again, we've become rather smug, haven't we? Meager little minds. Great minds embrace it all. Great minds absorb the teachings of masonry and change the way they're approaching the world around them. They make the fundamental change. If I'm such a fool that I think that the math and sciences are all that's necessary for the progress of humanity, then has Freemasonry failed me, or have I failed as a student of Freemasonry? The obligation is on the shoulders of each one of us to take advantage of the opportunity. Oh, is that time limited? I only have to do that for the first 10 years or until I have some gold braid? Where in the world did that come from? You just make that up as you go along? Remember, you're talking to somebody that appreciates the first local traditions, not yours and mine. The first local traditions, because we have so much more to learn from them than this self-serving stuff that we've gotten into lately. Yeah, and I say that. I don't say that to be mean. I say it as an observation. So what do we do here? Now we're all in these arcs and we see other arcs on the horizon. Some are passing us. Then we're doing all right. Ours, it's a Canadian version of it. I don't mind digressing a little bit and saying we maintain it well. It isn't big and cumbersome and have all an outfitted as if we're a paranoid bunch like some countries around, and I won't mention any names here. But we're well maintained. And when another ship, another arc of Freemasonry sees us, it represents, the craft that we're in represents a pride and a dignity. And yeah, there are bigger and better, but in our small patch of the ocean, we don't get hysterical. We have an ability to laugh at ourselves and put ourselves into context. We're enormously tolerant, but when we do get up collectively, things do change. Now, we've been on this arc floating around for a long time, haven't we? Over 150 years. Now, most of the boys, they've said, well, you know, nothing's really going on. I'm a bit bored, so it's time to get out of here. Well, they didn't really put it that way. They said, oh, my time has come. I'm going back home to meet the Creator. They're dying off. So there's more room on the arc. Now, we're used to rubbing shoulders, so my goodness, when we have all of this freedom to actually stretch, it's a creepy little feeling, isn't it? We don't see more lifeboats coming up to us and say, well, come on, keep coming on. Do you have a brain in your head? Do you read? Doesn't matter. You got a pulse. There, come on. You've got a willingness to be part of us? Yeah, climb aboard. Because out of 100 of you, there might be one that has the capacity, and we want to keep our nets small enough so that we can sieve out all of the rest that just sort of kept floating by from those that are thinking men. And a guy could start off just bobbing along because he's been raised by farm animals, and all of a sudden he absorbs the atmosphere and attitude of Freemasonry. And it takes 5 to 10 to 15 to 20 to 25 years. So we have something that we are growing. We have these experiments, men who are moving through the course of their life at their own pace, willing to come to a lodge and be part of the activity, always risking exposure to the deeper ideas. And oh my goodness, isn't that one of the hardest things of all to admit? That we don't get it all. That we don't understand it all. Not nearly as much as we want to admit. Do we get it all? Only a foolish person would ever claim something like that. But we're all in these arcs. Now we're looking over into this. We've been looking at our own reflections in the surface of the ocean. And some of us are saying, I wonder what's under the surface. I wonder if we jump into that, what would we discover? Well, you discover, I'm not going to tell you that you're going to jump in on the top of a rock. We're out here in the middle of the deep ocean. What you're going to jump into is the darkness. And when you open your eyes under there, you're going to see little spots of light, brilliance, philosophy, Pythagoras, saying to us all, shh, we want to cultivate your mind, settle your mind first so that it can absorb deeper ideas. You're okay with the superficial notions of life, but you're here to open your mind to deeper understanding. Your voice is beautiful, but not for the first couple of years here. You just be quiet and go and sit over there. You attend everything that we say you should attend. You're going to develop a different way of thinking. Your mind is going to change. If we want you to learn how to appreciate light, we'll cover your eyes. We'll cover your eyes. It's very disorienting. Try it for 2 hours, 3 hours. Like those psychology experiments in university. Oh, my. Once you take the bandages off, you're paying attention. And that impression doesn't leave you. First you feel sick to your stomach. Then you get wobbly and disoriented and dizzy. And then anxious. Or all of that all at once. What do you find? The work of Pythagoras that teaches us you'll be okay if you want into the college. This is the way we do it. The world can be appreciated mathematically. You'll be a face coming out of darkness. Just the outline of your face. Nothing else can be seen. You're breathing, you're sensate. You'll see things that you don't understand yet. You shouldn't understand because you haven't learned how to settle your mind and study. What do we have to settle? Ego. Oh my goodness, ego. We have to be right. Have to be on top. Have to be a leader. Have to have power. Really? The hell is that? What is power, eh? Well, that's the stuff that Pythagoras is asking. Is power in the mind of a person that tells us he's powerful? Oh dear, really? It's a form of power, I guess. It's not very deep. It's muscular. So we have to learn about that. The power of the mind. Knowledge. Why, when we all is said and done, seem to agree that knowledge is power? Oh, well, you must be talking about weaponry. Only if I'm a fool. This is a deep ocean. Your mind and thoughts run very deep. But you need a guide. You need a mentor. Freemasonry offers us more than we can possibly imagine. Even at the surface, we can admit that it is daunting. Ideas, words like the occult and alchemy, values, ethics, philosophy, purpose come to mind. But my goodness, it's very hard to be serious because it's wearing. So we only do it in small bits. You tune in, you get onto your computer now and tune this in. But this kind of conversation isn't one that you walk around having every single day. It isn't. It's impractical. But it's here when you are receptive to it. And when we're busy getting our work and kit ready in Lodge, whether we're a regular member or one of the wardens, we have duties, things and responsibilities that are going to preoccupy us. And even then, we become more and more observant if we're fortunate. So is Freemasonry failing? No, that's like saying air is failing. We're doing some weird things to it, but air? It's like saying the sun is failing. Whoa, is it burning out? That's your definition of failure? That huge reactor burning out, really? You'll do anything to make a point, won't you? We will do anything to make a point. It's just amazing. So are we all in this together? Are we back on board? Are we realizing, does this make sense to you? Yeah, that we're philosophically based. That's been the attraction. That's the flavor of this process. That's what affects our senses completely. Not the smell of mold. That's what makes us sick. Oh, we do maintenance, but we can be, groups of men can be enormously stupid. Oh, have we become self-conscious about being together in groups of men? The small-minded and weak-minded certainly have. We want to, you know, remove that. We want to, we don't know how to articulate the fact that we are fraternity, what that represents and why that's important. So we say, well, let's just remove that because I can't figure out an answer to it. So we'll just remove the question. I like to think that that and know that the philosophy doesn't die, never did, never can. We can ignore it. We've been sitting up in the ark looking at our own reflections. We love that. We love to see ourselves. Look at it. We're so pretty in our tuxedos, in our tails, so pretty. And look at it. We're smiling and friendly. Not a clue what the hell's going through that mind. Don't get me wrong. Every mother's son looks better in a tux. Come on. You know what I'm saying? So we all hold hands, jump in together. Well, it's already been starting. Already been starting. We are in the age of communication. Amen to that. Here, little earworm. Be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a harder battle. Mm-hmm. Every heart sings a song incomplete until another heart whispers back. Those who wish to sing always find a song. At the touch of a lover, everyone becomes a poet. Wise men speak because they have something to say. Fools because they have to say something. Oh my goodness. We can easily forgive a child who is afraid of the dark. The real tragedy of life is when men are afraid of the light. Willful ignorance? And to the men and women who continue to carry on at the battlefront, only the dead have seen the end of war. Wow. That pains me. That kind of truth pains me. Do not train a child to learn by force or harshness, but direct them to it by what amuses their minds, so that you may be better able to discover with accuracy the peculiar bent of the genius of each. You can discover more about a person in an hour of play than in a year of conversation. Never discourage anyone who continually makes progress, no matter how slow. Good people do not need laws to tell them to act responsibly, while bad people will find a way around the laws. Thank you. This is stuff, work from, what, 3rd century BC? Plato, yeah. Good people do not need laws. This is a lesson Cyril taught his grandson in the fields in outside of Rustigo. I remember which direction we were walking. We were walking back toward the farmhouse. I think we had needed a wrench to make an adjustment on a haymow. The horses were still strapped into it, but, so we had to be walking, and at a good pace, and the ruts in the field meant I felt like I was doing the hurdles. This is what he told me. Good men, he said, good men don't need the law and police. Uh, I am the wisest man alive, for I know one thing. That is that I know nothing. Ah. Interest in college. How do we discipline ourselves? Yeah. Let's be generous. Human behavior flows from three main sources: desire, emotion, and knowledge. Yeah. There are three classes of men: lovers of wisdom, lovers of honor, and lovers of gain. I like being around, walking around with those kind of truths. Now, we're going to talk about something that occurred in 1627. Well, I know you're all there. I know you're all, you all have memories from 1627. I want to know the point that makes me want to preserve the ancient ways more and more, learn about them and talk about them. This silly little music from the medieval tavern, you know, the ambient music that I played. We're discovering that happiness can be achieved through nostalgia. Once upon a time, nostalgia was considered a lead to depression and anxiety. And now we're finding out that it's exactly the opposite. That we can draw on the best parts of our past. Oh, by the way, did you get that message? You draw on the best parts of the past. Not your puffery. The best parts of the best things, the happy moments. Bring them forward. They help us to cope and put what's going on around us each and every day into a context that's healthy. Nostalgia. It made me, when I started to read about this research that's going on, it just was wonderful. It's like an affirmation of everything Masonic. We are enormously nostalgic. Now, some stop and say, we're good historians. Well, we're not really good. But we love the nostalgia, the way that we bring forward the rules and protocols that were of our grandfather's time. That's about as far as our memories can go. That's why I feel that the corrosiveness of local traditions needs to be repaired, because the local traditions always evolve into something else bizarre until we're so far removed from our original pace. We can hardly recognize it. In a way, that's what I think has happened to our appetites for learning. We've been distracted. Let me tell you about the New Atlantis. You ready for this? 1627, but still relevant to this day. And this was written by somebody that you will all may have heard, I hope you have, a writer called the first Viscount St. Alban, Francis Bacon. Yeah. He was born on the 28th of October. He was born on the 22nd of January, 1561. Yeah, same day as my wife's birthday. And he was an English philosopher and statesman and scientist and an orator. And he served as both the Attorney General and Lord Chancellor of England. This is after he was born during the beheading of Charles I, eh? And the Civil War. That was the period. After his death, he was very influential through his works. And he was a strong advocate and practitioner of the scientific method. Yeah, the scientific, that's a body of techniques for investigating a phenomena and acquiring new knowledge or correcting and integrating previous knowledge. So you can see we're talking post-Renaissance here. Not that 1,000 years from 400 to the 15th century, where things were translated. The unknown was translated by for us all by the church. Thank you. 1,000 years, darkness. It's not really. There were things going on, but we, you know, sum it all up. And it as a period of delay. So the scientific method is a method or procedure characterized by the natural sciences since the 17th century. And it's simply like this, a systematic observation, a measurement, and experiment. And you test ideas, the modification of hypothesis. That's all. You're trying ideas. You're not running from them. You're testing them. So remember, systematic observation, it's not just what you see once. Oh, something bad happened to me today, so we have to overreact and take out insurance for it. Really? You knucklehead, the world isn't built that way. Anyway, Francis Bacon, that's Francis. And he wrote this, New Atlantis. Check it out here. It was the early science fiction novel, and it sets out how to show how science will transform the world. Science is the major intellectual enterprise of the Bethlehemites, who are presented as exemplary citizens. So you made this up. So you and I are reading now over the shoulder of Francis Bacon, and he's writing about New Atlantis, not old Atlantis, you know, but uptown Atlantis. So the Bethlehemites were the characters here. They were exemplary. They were devout Christians, heterosexual, and much given to ritual and ceremonial. So we can tease that out. We're getting around the first Freemasons here, Frank, Francis. These elements were included to allay fears already nascent in the 17th century that science was the enemy of social order and godliness. The godless world of science. Has that been pounded into our little brains again and again and again? We should have Dawkins on here. Let's see if I can talk more about his work, Richard Dawkins. For early Freemasons seeking to pursue their perfectly proper researches into the hidden mysteries of science and nature, such popular attitudes laid the foundations for subsequent hostility, suspicion, and ridicule based on ignorance and fear. The utopian theme is hidden in the name of the group, Ben, or son of, and Salem, a synonym for Zion, the citadel of Jerusalem, or the world to come. Quite simply, the Bethlehemites were sons of the world to come. That process had gained considerable momentum by the time William Preston began to advance his vision of Freemasonry. Ha ha! I think you were talking to me just the other day about that, weren't you? The traditional history of Freemasonry was set out by William Preston in his Illustrations of Masonry. And this argues that the pre-Roman Druids possessed the secrets of Pythagoras. Really? Come on, Bill. Convince us. Several noble Romans who held dominion over the English were deemed to have ranked themselves as patrons and protectors of the craft. Well before the Romans left, Caracasius became the dominant local leader. He was, effectively, an usurping German emperor whose strength lie with his control of crews of barbarian sailors. According to Preston, Carausius acquired the love and esteem of the most enlightened part of his subjects by assuming the character of a Mason. From that point on, the contrived history becomes even more fanciful until it nears Preston's own times, when he could write from knowledge. On this early history, it is difficult to quarrel with Dr. Robert Plott, when he described the early history of the craft as it was presented in his day, as bad as this history of the craft itself, than which there is nothing I ever met with more false or incoherent. Preston was not overtly seeking an utopia, but rather extolling the virtues of the craft by demonstrating that Monarchs throughout the ages have patronized our mysteries and joined in our assemblies. Yet what he does in the opening pages of Book One is to set out the means by which the mind of a man can be influenced by his surroundings. He builds an image that Richard Jefferies was to recreate in 1885 in a book called After in London, when some unspecified disaster had wiped out mankind. Preston wrote, "Were a man placed in a beautiful garden, would not his mind be affected with exquisite delight on a calm survey of its rich collections? Would not the groves and the grottos, the artful wilds, the flowery parterres, the opening vistas and the lofty cascades, the winding streams, the whole variegated scene, awaken his sensibility and inspire his soul with the most exalted ideas?" This idea is developed into an argument in favor of friendship. The source of universal benevolence inspires that public spirit and heroic ardor which enables us to support a good cause and risk our lives in its defense. In more tranquil scenes, we behold it, the friendship of brotherhood, calm and moderate, burning with an even glow, improving the soft hours of peace and heightening the relish for virtue. In those happy moments, contracts are formed, societies are instituted, and the vacant hours of life are employed in the cultivation of social and polished manners. Friendship. Make our parents proud. In my case, since I was raised by wolves, I adopt the manners that I see and learn from around me. Preston's utopia was to have at its core universal friendship or world brotherhood, since that is how he develops his argument. Such a force would create a polished, civilized, and thoughtful society, striving to improve the lot of all men. The true Mason is a citizen of the world, and his philanthropy extends to all the human race. Just think about this. Join me with that moment of nostalgia. Just think about what Preston is saying to us here. What a wonderful, wonderful world. Just enjoy it. It's almost like a perfect idea. The true Mason is a citizen of the world. Wow. That suggests an understanding, an appreciation, a capacity to bring forward good ideas from the other side of the world to improve. From a Masonic point of view, Preston's writings seem to mark the first significant lay presentation of the view that a personal utopia might lie within the process of a search or arise from rigorous self-examination. In other words, that personal utopia can exist within you. Overcome the view of disappointment of the world around and the shortcomings within your mind. That true Mason does exist. Beyond that, such a practice carried out with like-minded fellows could bring a universal benefit. Hear. It's when I meet you, all that affirmation comes forward. I see the good works, the good attitude, the goodness in Masons around me. That's you. His thoughts mark the first tentative step toward an ideal or utopian world based on Masonic principles. This line of reasoning drew upon earlier hylomorphic thinking, prompted by the study of fossils found in stone. Seeking an explanation for the presence of these proofs of past life, the primitive speculatives or natural philosophers concluded that they were the remains of waste material discarded by the Almighty as he created Eden. Now there's a little biblical reference here. Genesis 2, verses 4 to 17. This in turn led to the presumption that if the secrets hidden in such stone could be unlocked, man would find the key to a new golden age, an age of perfection and happiness that could be shared with all mankind. It was to this inquiry that early speculative Mises turned their minds. Their perception of utopia was a vision based on the biblical account of Eden, which could be restored if only the key, the lost secret, could be found. What better to unlock the mystery of stone than the genuine secrets of a master mason? The unfortunate legacy of St. Augustine's reluctance to question ideas that seemed to challenge the presumed authority of God did not permit this line of reasoning to move comfortably forward. That constraint was removed during the Age of Enlightenment, as men became both more willing and better equipped to examine the physical world and ponder its metaphysical dimension. In his Elements of Architecture, published in 1624, Henry Wotton, that's spelled W-O-T-T-O-N, for those of you who are keeping track of such things, in 1624, Henry Wotton had wondered about the innate mystery of stone when he wrote, "Ordinary stone without any garnish of sculpture do yet ravish the beholder by a secret harmony." He wonders what it has inside. Who was the sculptor that said, when asked how does he create such brilliant sculpture, he just took away all the things that didn't belong? This view was developed when he argued that operative masons should speculate upon the reasons why their work produces, quote, "a graceful and harmonious contentment," which speculation, though it may appear in vulgar artisans perhaps too subtle and too sublime, commandeth in an architect a philosophical spirit that is no specific, superficial, and floating artificer, but a diver into causes. The artificer, the person you need that has a bit of knowledge about everything, makes things work, makes things come together. But in 1624, much about the world was in a state of rapid and sometimes violent flux. Europe was being torn apart by the 30 Years' War. Galileo was exploring the mysteries of the universe. The New World was adding another dimension of trade and thought. Kepler was shaping the laws of planetary motion. Napier had given the world logarithms. Harvey had described the circulation of the blood, and philosophy was caught up in the debate between the medievalists and their search for why, and the modernists who were disposed to ask how. Henry Wotton's reflections on the nature of stone suggest how this debate influenced the consideration of the metaphysical dimension of stone masonry and led him to hint at a utopian trend in operative thinking, predating the initiation of Elias Ashmole, October 1646. That's a lot. We'll stop. That's a lot in developing the ideas of pulling together the ideas that seem to be almost, glibly stated, as if everybody understands. So think of the medieval philosophies as asking the question why, and then, as we hear, the modernists asking how. And you might want examples of the modernist philosophy. I'll leave that with you right now. And it is an interesting field of study. And they were right. So when you see this assumption that the period that we're talking about in 17th century was a period of great violence, can you bring it forward to compare that to what was going on today? Is it the style of a battle that's different? Is it any different that people die? And is it any different that history bears witness to the fact that there's an end? And the true points of the battle are lost to us, that the agenda moves forward just as it always has. Yeah. So where do we go from there, right? It's a wonder. It is a wonder. So I'm going to end today. Thank you for joining me. It's been an amazing period of time. Truly amazing. It's been... it's your round. It's your round coming up. You know it is, you cheap thing. Here's a little music coming up. It's around the holiday period of time. This is getting into, I don't want to get into Christmassy things just yet, eh? Not just yet. But winter solstice is coming up. And the Yule. This is the music we would have heard in medieval times, when we're still asking questions why. We observe the shortest day of the year, and followed by the longest night. So ancient peoples, since the Neolithic, celebrated this event as a festival. Remember Stonehenge. We just passed the anniversary of the death of Robert Browning. He's an English poet. You might want to check it out. It's interesting. For some of you that are poets at heart, and those who haven't studied it yet, there's much to be gained. I've heard it said that poetry speaks the emotion of the earth. It's interesting, eh? So, this day, the 12th, just passed, he died. He's known, his wife was Elizabeth Barrett Browning. So, do yourself a kindness. Give yourself a pre-holiday gift. And I'll look forward to seeing you all real soon. Commit acts of random Masonic kindness. Let the great architect know that you do exist. His presence is all around us. I'm going to go and dig into the Pied Piper of Hamelin. It's one of my favorites. Oh, yeah. Robert Barry Browning wrote that. Yeah, very cool. You take care of yourselves.